Iran says part of its demands over the removal of U.S. sanctions have not been considered yet in the Vienna talks. Negotiations are set to resume tomorrow. Russia says the West has yet to respond to its requests about security guarantees as the U.S. deploying more troops to Poland amid tensions. The African Union condemns what it calls the wave of unconstitutional changes of government in the bloc's member states. Live from our Tehran headquarters, this is World News. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Now, beginning with our top story, Iran saying that a good agreement in the Vienna talks on the 2015 accord hinges on the behavior and goodwill of the other parties. Foreign Minister Hossein Amin Abdullahi says parts of Iran's demands are yet to be addressed in the discussions. He said that that will be the subject of the upcoming negotiations with the P4+1. The foreign minister said that all sides will focus on a joint document in which they state their commitment to the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions. The secretary of the Supreme National Security Council has also warned that Tehran will enter no agreement in the talks that do not end the U.S. maximum pressure campaign. Ali Shamkhani says that any agreement that does not remove the bans could not be a basis for a favorable deal. The European Union has also confirmed that the Vienna negotiations will be resuming on Tuesday.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic pitch. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley has said that Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the 2015 Iran deal. At the same time, Secretary of Iran's National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has had important messages for the opposing side. first that even in the event of a deal, Tehran will still pursue its civilian nuclear program. And secondly, Iran will adhere to its stance that there needs to be a verifiable lifting of sanctions.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantee that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the US and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
More U.S. troops arrive in southeastern Poland following an order by President Biden. This is the latest development in the stand-up between the West and Moscow over Ukraine. Over the past few days, as fears of U.S. elite forces, advance groups, and military vehicles arrived in an airport near the Polish border with Ukraine. And those measures follow Western allegations that Russia is planning an invasion of the country. Moscow dismisses the allegation. Also, Russian President Vladimir Putin is meeting with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, on Monday. The Kremlin says that a crisis over Ukraine is set to dominate the talks, but it's not expecting any decisive breakthrough from that meeting. Moscow says that the U.S. and its allies have not responded to the security guarantees that the Kremlin has demanded regarding NATO's eastward expansion. We've asked journalist Dmitry Zolotarev to share with us his perspective of the current stand-up, and he says that the U.S. is using Ukraine as a pretext to impose more sanctions on Russia.
As I see it, it's just another show-off from the world champion of lies, the United States government. The fact is, they just using any pretext to impose more sanctions or pressure on Russia, so they create fake allegations, absolutely not unsubstantiated, to show in the Western media that Russia is preparing to full-scale war and wants to destroy Ukraine, so on and so forth. The fact is that all those moves of the United States troops to Europe is just another way of the United States and NATO to come closer to Russian borders.
Now, the African Union denounces a recent wave of military coups sweeping the continent, saying that military governments will not be tolerated.
Every African leader in the assembly has condemned unequivocally the pattern of, or the resurgence, or the cycle, or the wave of unconstitutional changes of government.
Adeyoye says that this is the first time that four countries have been suspended from the bloc in 12 months. He was speaking at the end of a two-day African Union summit in the Ethiopian capital. The chair of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mahamat, also warned of a democratic backpedaling in the continent, saying that it's not acceptable. Less than 2 weeks before the summit began Saturday, Burkina Faso became the fourth country to be suspended from the bloc after Guinea, Mali, and Sudan. The EU has been accused of devilish standards, however, by not suspending Chad after a military council takeover. Analysts also say the body must be more proactive to prevent putches. The African Union has suspended a debate on whether to revoke Israel's observer status, and that follows controversy sparked by a unilateral decision last year to grant the regime accreditation. The decision was made by the chairman of the AU's commission and helped the regime receive the status after two decades. More details in the next report.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. Row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more overtly like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. Because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer's status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year. A decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
The Islamic Revolution in 1979 replaced Iran's monarchy with an Islamic establishment that has been governing the country since then. Correspondent Anjuman Abdullahi reports on the impact of the revolution in Nigeria.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and old alike, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Now, Iran is commemorating the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank say that since the 1979 revolution, Iran's unconditional support for the Palestinian people and their resistance against Israel has not stopped. Mona Kandy reports.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities.
Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The next point, which in my opinion is very important, is the issue of preserving unity in the country. We must reduce the factors that create discord as much as we can. Of course, there are differences in opinion, viewpoints, methods, and mentalities. These things exist. But we should not let them lead to taking stances against one another. The people's solidarity should not be destroyed by these things. We should not allow these differences to become exacerbated. Of course, there are naturally some individuals who stand up against the revolution, and the revolution has no choice but to stand up against them. But if the issue is about differences of opinion and differences in taste, and if these differences exist in society, they should not cause national solidarity to be destroyed. In other words, the collective decision to defend the country, to help the country progress, and to inspire hope in the youth of the country should remain firmly in place. We should know that there are always some people in the enemy's camp whose expertise is creating discord. They have an expertise in creating discord in order to rule, divide and rule. This is an old policy which originates from these individuals. They know how to do this. We see that they have done this wherever they could. One such policy is creating religious discord. For instance, between Shia and Sunni. We should not allow these things to happen or to become exacerbated in the country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, Shia and Sunni people have been living together for centuries. They have been living together without any problems for many years. Of course, there have been some differences between some ethnic groups. There have been some issues between various ethnic groups, but there have not been any problems or conflicts between the Shia and the Sunni. Now, if some individuals find an excuse to create such discord, of course such a thing has not happened so far, but we should not let it happen and we must be vigilant. For instance, if someone makes a wrong comment and someone else responds to them out of their sense of responsibility, this should not be dragged out and continued. Therefore, everyone should preserve this state of solidarity. Pay attention to this fact, that the Islamic Republic is an Islamic government and its flag is the flag of Shi'ism. But even in the Islamic countries where Sunnis are living, sometimes people express their interest in the Islamic Republic. They express their interest, advocacy, cooperation and support. In many countries from East Asia to West Africa, there are those who look at the Islamic Republic in this way, but they are not Shia.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organization, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this special edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss ways in which the Islamic Revolution, spearheaded by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, echoed far and wide, including in the Himalayan region of Kashmir. And we shall also delve into the tremendous impact of the 1979 revolution in neighboring Afghanistan and Pakistan and India.
Soon after the pro-West regime in Iran was toppled through a popular social-political movement in 1979, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, declared that the revolution will challenge the arrogant powers across the world. The idea was incorporated in the country's constitution, affirming Iran's support for the oppressed against the oppressors. It later gave shape to a revolutionary movement that took the Islamic world by storm, including the South Asian region.
What began as a popular nationwide uprising against the hideous plot to westernize Iran later transformed into a global movement against despotism, tyranny, and hegemonic schemes of arrogant powers. Nations took inspiration from Imam Khomeini's spirited resistance to free his country from the clutches of foreign powers. Over the past four decades, the movement has gripped the hearts and minds of people everywhere. Among the regions greatly influenced by the Islamic Revolution is the picturesque Himalayan region of Kashmir, a contested Muslim-majority territory ravaged by decades of conflict. This abode of Sufis and saints, which embraced Islam in the 14th century at the hands of Iranian missionaries like Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani, adopted Imam Khomeini's revolution in letter and spirit. Since 1979, pro-resistance groups in the region have used Iran's Islamic Revolution as a powerful mechanism to mobilize masses against forces that perpetuate injustices and snatch people's fundamental rights.
In the whole subcontinent, Islamic Revolution of Iran, especially the struggle of great people like Imam Khomeini and all those people, Shahid Mutahhari and Ayatollah Abdul Hussein Dastagheyev. We have long list of everybody who participated and supported Imam. There are more Islamic seminaries. There are more religious awareness. More people are turning away from the secularism and going towards the religious schools and preparing their sons and daughters and their next generation to understand Islam, especially the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, more deeply. And there is a great awareness among the people, which would never have been possible without this great revolution that is not only just from the social point of view, but also from the political and religious point of view.
The appeal of Imam Khomeini's resistance manual cuts across the sectarian lines, with both Shias and Sunnis crediting him for reinvigorating their struggle for freedom from oppression, subjugation, and occupation. Today, the biggest rallies to mark the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution outside Iran are held in the cities of Srinagar and Kargil. Streets in both the cities are dotted with pictures and banners, paying tribute to Imam Khomeini and his intrepid companions.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran has an impact on hearts and minds of Kashmiris over the past few decades. And you know, I believe it still lives in our hearts as a society and community. Now, I also believe that it has harnessed our inner belief to rise above the basic evil thought process of sectarian divide and how to revolutionize and evolve our stand for communal harmony on humanitarian grades.
Be it Yemen, Syria, Palestine, or the Valley of Kashmir, the Islamic Revolution in Iran has set up an example for all the people living in chaotic and politically unstable regions. It not only inspires us to be strong while we are at the verge of losing hope, but also teaches us the responsibilities that we should bear so that we can together overthrow the oppressive powers and walk the path of justice.
The wave of the Islamic revival, fueled by the 1979 Islamic Revolution, has engulfed the entire region. To invoke the Islamic Revolution, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said it's akin to the scent of spring flowers carried by the breeze to different corners of the Islamic world. In Kashmir, the scent seems to feel more strongly, partly because of Imam Khomeini's deep and personal affiliation with the region. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has also followed the same roadmap of what is known today as the world's most militarized zone.
When Imam Khomeini, during his exile in France, was asked by a French journalist where he would prefer to go if his asylum was revoked, his answer was Kashmir. His choice wasn't anything strange. Earlier, while in Iraq, he had exchanged a series of letters with the then top Shia cleric in Kashmir, Sayyid Yusuf Musavi, who had invited him to Kashmir. The unshakable allegiance of Kashmiris to the ideals of Islamic revolution has to be seen in the context of the advocacy of their long-standing political struggle by both Imam Khomeini and his worthy successor. Imam Khomeini, way back in 1965, during a speech in Najaf, had equated Kashmir with Palestine. Imam Khomeini, known for his plain speech, has often emphasized the just struggle of Palestinians and Kashmiris.
Islamic revolution is the hope for the people, oppressed people across the world. Islamic revolution is one of the important historical incidents of the 20th century. We cannot ignore this because of this that caused many historic events and social and political changes across the world. In our region, in Jammu, Kashmir and Ladakh, we have seen so many, many you know, modernist reforms that people have become very conscious. They are inspired from Islamic revolution and ideology of Imam Khomeini.
People in the Himalayan region, most notably Srinagar and Kargil, today draw spiritual and resistance leadership from Iran. They celebrate the triumph of the Islamic Revolution and mourn the martyrs of the Holy Defense. They burn the effigies of Trump and Pompeo and hold memorials for Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. This is the miracle of Imam Khomeini and his revolutionary legacy.
The influence of the Islamic Revolution has over the years extended far and wide, leaving virtually no part of the subcontinent untouched. In Muslim-majority Pakistan, the wave of the 1979 revolution, spearheaded by Imam Khomeini, enveloped the country in the early 1980s as a response to Takfiri extremism. People saw it as a revolutionary movement aimed at Islamic revival. More than four decades later, a vast majority of Muslims in the South Asian country are vocal adherents of the Imam Khomeini school of resistance.
Under Pakistan's former military dictator, Zia-ul-Haq, a deeply sinister project of Islamization was unleashed, which essentially used Islam as an instrument to consolidate his political power. In contrast, the Islamic Revolution came with a purpose and attracted many followers. Soon after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, under the spiritual leadership of Imam Khomeini, Pakistani Shias came together for the first time to form Tehreek-e-Jafariya Pakistan. The spread of the Islamic Revolution in Pakistan coincided with the rise of Wahhabi Takfirism, bankrolled by Arab regimes, which in turn led to killings of many prominent Shia leaders like Allama Arif Hosseini. Known as Khomeini-e Pakistan, Martyr Arif Hosseini was the founder of Tehreek-e-Jafariya. The violence, however, did not deter the leadership.
Martyrdom of Arif Hosseini was definitely the result of Pakistani support to Islamic Revolution, and the state very much, you know, had to do a lot of, you know, struggle to find out the culprits. But we know that there have been many other, you know, successive assassinations of prominent Shia denominational leadership in Pakistan. It was only because of the tension between the powers and activists between the supporters of Islamic Revolution and the opponents of or the people who are somehow still this tension is still prevailing there. But the religious awareness, the struggle against the resistance, and the voice of the oppressed people. For example, the resistance against Israel and the support for Palestinians became very stronger.
Many social and political groups came into being over the years inspired by the Islamic Revolution. Today, many leading political organizations in Pakistan owe their existence to the same revolution. Majlis-e-Wahdat-e-Muslimin, founded in 2009, indefatigably espouses the political cause of minorities in Pakistan. Most of its leaders are drawn from the Imamiyah Students Organization, one of the largest student organizations in the country, with 800 branches and almost 26,000 members. ISO's activities are inspired by the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. Many of its members have been martyred in recent years, fighting Daesh under the banner of Zainabiyun.
Although successive governments in New Delhi reluctantly embraced the Islamic Republic after 1979, Muslims in the Hindu-majority country were also exposed to the currents of the Islamic Revolution. Since the country boasts of around 200 million Muslims, the ruling elites in New Delhi have long chosen to tread cautiously. With the BJP in power, things appear to be changing now. On the other side, the Islamic Revolution has had deepest sway in neighboring Afghanistan, where many top Afghan leaders across the ideological spectrum have taken inspiration from Imam Khomeini.
India is home to the second largest Muslim population in the world after Indonesia. The country also has the second most Shia concentration in the world after Iran. Indian Muslims in general and Indian Shias in particular have been known for deep ideological and religious ties with the Islamic Republic, even though their patriotism has never been in question. The ideals of the Islamic Revolution have a large audience in the country, which is evident in massive pro-Iran demonstrations. On International Quds Day, for instance, large rallies are held in big cities like New Delhi, Mumbai, Hyderabad, and Lucknow. On Iranian anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani's assassination 2 years ago, thousands of people took to the streets across India to reaffirm their support for the resistance axis.
The Islamic Revolution of 1979 gave an international identity to the Muslims of India and the subcontinent, especially the Shias. People still idolize many Iranians in all walks of their life. For example, in the CAA protests where students were lathi-charged by the police, a group of students resorted to giving red roses to the policemen, which is an inspiration from what Imam Khomeini had ordered the Iranians to do during the Islamic Revolution of 1979.
Islamic Revolution led by Imam Khomeini not only changed the mindset of people regarding politics, but also changed the beliefs of people regarding religion. It taught us that we should not keep politics away from religion.
In Afghanistan, the erstwhile Hizb-e-Wahdat-e-Islami, founded by the late Hazara leader Abdul Ali Mazari, was the outcome of efforts made by the Islamic Revolution ideologues. Mazari had close ties with Imam Khomeini. His successors, Karim Khalili and Muhammad Muhaqqiq, later maintained those ties, although the organization became a shadow of its past following the killing of Mazari in 1995. The influence of the Islamic Revolution in Afghanistan also saw thousands of youths defending the holy shrines from Daesh terrorists in Syria under the banner of Fatemiyun Brigade. The victory against the terrorist group was made possible by these valiant warriors.
Islamic Revolution of Iran has a huge contemporary significance for the Muslim Ummah across the globe. It shows us, it gives us a hope that even in today's times, when everything has become so complex, with societies losing their basic fabric to illogical hijab bans, or Islamophobia, if I may say, Islamophobia on an all-time high. Nevertheless, the revolution has a direct impact on it for each of our lives. Every day we see stories that inspire us. We have people to look forward to, people who stand against injustice and trying to put into action the teachings of peace, brotherhood, justice, tolerance, and all this in the light of divine religion of Islam.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Sayyid Ruhullah Mousavi, former minister and legislator of Kashmir. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini affirmed the Islamic Republic of Iran's support to the oppressed against the oppressors worldwide. Now, do you think this has helped the Islamic Revolution become a worldwide phenomenon?
Hello. Hello to you and your audience. Thanks for having me. The Islamic Revolution post-1979 became an worldwide phenomenon, especially the approach towards Israel issue, the Palestinian issue, the rights for Palestinian existence, which became the center of its worldview, and the way Iran, especially post-revolution, behaved in favor of the oppressed, has helped the revolution spread across as a mean for those who were oppressed to get a voice. It gave voice to the oppressed who were not heard of as strongly as post-revolution. And you can see many such instances even today playing internationally, where we see people in Yemen and people in Iraq taking their strength from the principles of the Islamic Revolution, where the oppressed get strength and the voice is given to the oppressed, and support is moral support is given to the oppressed. So all the events, world events, especially in Middle East from 1979 to this date, suggest that the Islamic Revolution became an instrument of a voice, instrument of strength. The oppressed people derive their moral strength from the Islamic Revolution, which reflects from the Palestinian issue and the issues in Middle East, so to speak, about Iraq and Yemen particularly.
Mr. Mousavi, the movement aimed at Islamic revival, spearheaded by Imam Khomeini in the early 1980s, reverberated across the globe. Now, could you tell us more on its overall impact in Kashmir?
See, in Kashmir, the events have to be taken into context. The Islamic Revolution of Iran came in 1979, which was a very successful Islamic event. And soon after that, the Afghans took courage, and they derived the courage from this event. And we saw the, as a result of which, we saw the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan. So in the course of a decade, we saw two superpowers, quote-unquote superpowers of that time, who had to withdraw from their interests, the countries of interest. In case of America, the Shah had to withdraw and leave the country. And in case of Afghanistan, the other superpower of the time, Soviet Union, had to leave the country and withdraw from that. So these events which took place, the Kashmiris also thought, the people in Kashmir also took the courage and moral, they identified with the strength of this ideology. And though it may not be from me as an subscriber to a particular thought, but as an observer, I am giving this answer. The people in Kashmir derived their strength from these two facts and thought that the voice they wanted to be heard can be heard, and they came out courageously after these events. And since that time to this time, Kashmiris have seen, as a matter of fact, the revolution of Iran a moral support, which gives them the courage to speak to the power. And they feel that they, while being oppressed of the circumstances, they have something to look up to, an ideology like Islamic Revolution that helped the people in Afghanistan to drive courage as well. And therefore, the people in Kashmir drive the strength from this, where the oppressed is given the strength and the moral support from Iran.
So today we see the biggest rallies outside Iran on the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Kashmir, in cities like Srinagar and Kargil. What socio-political factors would you attribute to it?
Again, this is the result of the success of Islamic Revolution in Iran and the success of the same moral support and moral ideology, if we may want to put it that way. That was identical that we saw against Soviet Union in Afghanistan. A culture of courage while being oppressed developed in Kashmir as well, because the political circumstances were such. The people in Kashmir identified themselves with the people of Iran and Afghanistan. So since that time, it has become a culture in Kashmir where the people drive this moral support from the events of past, and they identify themselves with this ideology, which began from Iran, came to Afghanistan, and the different parts of the world where the oppressors were voiceless, developed a culture of hope and resistance. One is that. The other thing is, you have to take this into account. The faith plays a very important role when you see the processions, the amount of people coming on to celebrate the days of Islamic Republic, the anniversary of revolution. There's a particular element of faith, because post-revolution, the sections of the society, particularly in Kashmir, of sections of this faith, were voiceless. They had some sort of an identity crisis vis-a-vis the world all over. after these events, they could identify themselves at the world stage. They could find themselves an element, an important part of at the world stage, identifying themselves with the Islamic Revolution. So this courage, this faith, and this political atmosphere, this all cultivated into an atmosphere, this grew up into an atmosphere where you see people coming out on streets to celebrate this anniversary or this ideology, both in terms of faith, both in terms also in terms of culture and moral support.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Ruhollah Mousavi for his precious time, knowledge and insight. Now, let's see what people have been saying on social media.
Kashmir-based medical practitioner Dr. Abid Hussain cites a famous quote of the founder of the Islamic Revolution to stress that scholars must not justify the rule of barbaric, brutal regimes. Zulfaqar Ali, a seminary student from Kashmir, shares a picture from the International Quds Day rally in central Kashmir in which a Kashmiri child is seen trampling on the flag of the Zionist regime. A Twitter user shares a historic picture from 1980, 1 year after the Islamic Revolution, when Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir. A Twitter user, Zahra Mousavi, pays tribute to martyr Muhammad Ali Naghvi, a leader of Pakistani Shias and a follower of Imam Khomeini, who played a key role in popularizing the Islamic Revolution in Pakistan. Lashan Wani, a Kashmir-based TV journalist, posts a clip of massive protests in Shia-majority Kargil city following the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, with protesters chanting anti-US slogans.
And that was our special episode about the impact and influence of Iran's Islamic Revolution in the South Asian region. Thank you for your time, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
We congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son, he's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this segment are founded in the Holy Quran and in the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon him and upon his family, supplemented with scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Saeed. Last time we spoke about the fifth mistake some parents make when raising their children, and that is parents who are prone to hitting their children. Unfortunately, even though we said that that is not Islamically allowed under any circumstance, but nevertheless they hit their children, they have the tendency, unfortunately, to change the rules of engagement, we said. They would vary the punishment, they would change the punishment unexpectedly, and so on and so forth. Today we'll be continuing on that discussion, we'll be expanding on it, and we will also be mentioning what to keep in mind if you unfortunately have to hit your child, in your mindset at least. Dear Sayyid, please continue this discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. We said that if a parent resolves to hitting a child, even though they shouldn't,
right,
but just in case, you know, their anger gets them to a point where they must hit, then we get to say that there are a few things they need to keep in mind. We said there has to be, I think one of the last points that we mentioned, we said there has to be if you hit, you have to move from least to most.
Right.
You can't just come with your full strength and start taking punches and swings at a child.
Right, like an MMA fight.
So yeah, right. So you have to start slow, slow. Among the things that when it comes to hitting the child, you gotta make sure that you don't hit him for the first mistakes that he makes.
Right.
Because sometimes it could be this is the first mistake that he makes. If we give him a chance to apologize,
right,
if we give him a chance to realize his mistake, yeah, maybe he won't do it again, and the chances are pretty high that he won't.
Right.
But if it is his first mistake, for example, let's take an example here. If he breaks a cup or he does something that he usually doesn't do,
right,
could be his first time, you know, something happened to him, he dropped, an accident happens, yeah, and he broke something. If you come straight away and, you know, hit him for that mistake, you're just going to want to make the situation a lot worse.
Right.
Because if you have given him a chance to ask for forgiveness and realize his mistake, probably this mistake will not happen. So we say, first and foremost, look at what's been happening and make sure if it's the first time, you do not hit at all. All right? Another thing that we say that when it comes to hitting, make sure you don't hit a child under the age of 10. Because the child under age of 10, not only he is frail body-wise, but also mentally he's also frail. So not only you're going to harm his body, but you're also going to harm his mentality. You don't want to put him in a mood of being scared all the time.
Right, let's go ahead and take a quick break, dear Sayyid.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the mistake of hitting your child in anger and what to do to prevent this and what to focus on when you are dealing with such a situation. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we said a child under the age of 10 should not be hit. In fact, he should be shown more respect. And after 10, if a parent wants to hit, it's not that they should do, but it would be a lot less devastating to the child's mental and physical well-being.
Right, like we're saying,
after 10, at least he's big, he can handle that kind of pressure mentally and physically. Be under 10 is very hard for them. So this is also have to be kept in the mind of the parent who wants to hit.
Right.
Also, we get to say,